Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Tim Reedy, joined as usual by Father Matt Malone, and we're talking with Joia Lachlan about her experience and some of the photos she's put together that was part of an exhibit held here in Brooklyn, where she visited various food banks, but also the homes of people who are food insecure. I want to talk about one other photo here, Joey. We were just talking about it during the break. Picture of somebody just snowy day in Brooklyn, pulling a food cart, one of these, you know, famous food carts you see around New York City, and with President Street in the background. Maybe you can kind of tell us the story behind that.
That is President Street in Brooklyn. It's one of the major thoroughfares. Goes through several of the neighborhoods, Prospect Heights, Park Slope, a few others. If you remember, I think that was 2 years ago, we had so many blizzards, if you recall. It was like the snowiest winter ever.
And it's like four-day weeks in a row or something like that.
Exactly. And for me, in this project, it was so important to show the weather, right? If it was going to be snowing, I really wanted to be out there.
Right.
But it all had to line up because there aren't food pantries every day, and there aren't always food pantries when it's snowing and that kind of thing. So on that particular morning, I got out in the blizzard and found this small pantry in a rabbi's house. When you spend a lot of time in food pantries, you see that they come from they're very, very humble places and very sophisticated places. There are places that operate almost like supermarkets, and then there are places like this one where it's small, it's in the basement, but again, it's worthwhile to have access in the neighborhood for people, particularly like her. I didn't get to spend much time with her. She didn't, you know, she wasn't very chatty, but she was an elderly woman. She had gotten out.
Yeah,
in the
she's
snow.
Walking here with a cane in the snow.
A cane in the snow, and she was picking up for her neighbor, who was more infirm than she.
Wow.
And I found that frequently. Very often, people collect food for others in their apartment buildings who can't get out. They share the food that they get at the pantry. If they've taken too much or whatever, they'll put it in the lobby and other people pick it up. So while certainly there are issues with everything, in my experience, there was an awful lot of sharing and very little waste. But that woman in particular touched me because she was so stoic, and she put as much in as she could because she knew she had this other woman to take care of, and she was really determined, and I was touched.
And also, you're not going to make more than one trip in that kind of weather, right? And then in the photo we were talking about before the break, it's actually summer, and the folks in the line have their umbrellas up to shield them from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always something that you think about, but if you're going to be walking back and forth and carrying groceries, then what kind of weather you're doing that in makes a big difference, right?
Oh, absolutely. And then the experience of being in the line is another thing I had never thought about. But if you take a line like the one at the River Fund and many of the other lines, you do wait 2 and 3 hours. So you've calculated that it's worth your time to get that food. Because
right.
There are other ways that you can do things, but this is the choice that people make. So,
like, how many people would be standing in a line where you were waiting 2 or 3 hours?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. Yeah.
Hundreds.
Yeah.
And it's not just... It's, by and large, the person standing in the line is the person holding the family together, in my experience. But there are children there. There are elderly people there. There are kids, like, hanging out, reading, doing homework. You need to bring the kids with you. By and large, it's a lot of women and mothers on the line. And the kids are their responsibility. So, you know, the hours, the boredom, the weather,
right.
The things that people are willing to tolerate, they would not be there if they didn't need to be.
Right, right. It's not easier.
It's
right.
not
exactly.
easier.
Right.
Now, this is in our backyard, whereas, you know, we see pictures on the front page of the New York Times of food lines in Cuba, for example. And that gets a lot of attention. But stories like this, I don't know. It's in our own backyard, but we still don't seem to pay attention. And I don't know whether that's because we feel embarrassed as a society that we're not providing for these people, or it's just like, well, we'll always have the poor with us, and it's just something we have to live with. It's a hard question.
It is a hard question. And there is the fact that Americans were raised with Depression-era images of hunger, you know, of the Dust Bowl, or then you said Venezuela, but we would think of the original food crises in Africa that were so striking. These are less striking to us, but they are more real because right. They're our neighbors.
They're certainly more present to us. And there is a... do they interact with each other in the lines? Do they get to know each other, geez, I saw you here last month, or how? I mean, does any kind of community among the patrons form in those situations? I mean, because that's a lot of time to be together.
It's a lot of time to be together. The answer is yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. I don't know that people socialize away from the line, mm-hmm. but by and large, the lines are a collegial place. The people who work there try to make it as friendly as they can, but it's boring.
It's tedious.
Yeah. And you know, the pre-dawn in the freezing cold or standing in that heat, I don't want to play it down. I think people make the best of it. There's a lot of people talking on the phone,
right.
But it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. And is the reason that, are there not enough volunteers? Are there not enough folks working in the pantry? Is it simply that the demand is so much greater than the supply?
The demand is so much greater than the supply.
Okay.
I think that in the larger, look, there are different places that have lines that move more smoothly, and they mm-hmm. put a lot of time and effort into making that happen. Everybody's doing their best. But what's happened in the last 5 years in particular, since 08, the numbers of people in need has increased dramatically, and the spending towards people in need has not increased, or it's been cut. So the little cuts that you read about in the newspaper, you think that they don't matter so much. You'll see, oh, a 3% cut in food stamps. And you're like, oh, that's too bad. But the truth is, that's like $30 to somebody.
Right.
And when you're really counting your pennies, $30 is a lot of money. So what it means is that people who have some kind of support, like food stamps, they run out faster. So the lines at the food pantries towards the end of the month are crazy long compared to the beginning of the month.
Oh, I see.
So there's things like that that you'll see. And then, that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the people who staff these places and who organize them and volunteer there and work there. What are they like, and what are their motivations, and are there enough of them?
Well, I mean, one would like to believe that we wouldn't need them.
Right.
But that's not how it's going. And plenty have closed because the people managing them couldn't do it any longer, couldn't sustain it. But that's too bad, because the need is greater. They're by and large people who believe in social justice, and they believe that their fellow Americans should have enough to eat. So they're really your basic people who care about other people. Some of it is larger and institutional and organization-based. Some of it is smaller. Some of it is faith-based. Some of it is not. You know, in many of the smaller church pantries, you'll see your traditional church ladies there.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say is the strength and the dignity and the compassion of the people running the pantry. Sometimes I would go home from work and really feel as though I had been in the presence of goodness in the world. I'm like, if you're ever wondering if it's still there, it is still there, because I just spent 4 hours with a woman who was so incredibly in touch with someone in need that, you know, it's hard to watch, but beautiful to watch. But 'cause especially if you find yourself on a line and you don't expect to be there, some people are upset. You know, they don't feel great. Some people are depressed. Some people feel that they're never going to be able to take care of their families in the way that they feel responsible to do. So there's a lot of emotional support that's provided by the people who also supply the food. And they give direction. And many of these places are multidimensional, so they'll not just give you food, but they'll tell you where to go, what to do, put you in touch with other agencies, help you with your taxes. There's that kind of a thing. But there is the intimacy of the hand on the shoulder, how are you, that I think makes an enormous difference to somebody who's in that situation.
Yeah, it's like a form of ministry in a way, just being sensitive to people's needs, and that this is a difficult moment for them to have to come forward, especially if it's their first time. Just switching gears a bit, I wonder, as a photographer, what you've done here is really gained access to these very intimate moments in people's lives, and it took a lot of journalism and hardworking reporting to get that access. But I wonder, at a time when we're taking so many photographs of ourselves, with our phones, and there's more photographs in existence now than there ever have been, is it harder to get that kind of intimacy? Because, people, maybe they're used to a certain pose in front of the camera, and to allow you into their home and to be authentic, that must be hard, very difficult to get to that point.
Again, it's about time. It's about time and relationship. I would try to go back at least twice to the homes. That made an enormous difference. The first time is always the pose. The first hour is always useless.
Right.
The third hour is the best. The third visit is what you hope for.
Because they become more comfortable with you and with having you there, and they're more at ease. And
absolutely. And you really can't take someone's picture without their permission. It's how much they'll give you. And then the more you get to know each other, the more they're willing to share with you. And that's when I think you start to see what's going on in their life and how they would like to present themselves. It gives them some autonomy, which when you're just sort of snapping pictures at people, it's not the same. They don't have as much ownership of the experience.
How did some of the people you photographed respond to these images? Were they moved by them? Did they find it difficult to look at them? Or
yes and no. I mean, some yes, some no. Some felt great about it. I see you looking at that picture of May.
Yeah.
May is a woman who lives in Bed-Stuy. She's in her 60s. She's a seamstress. And
she's in her kitchen cooking some carrots.
She's in her kitchen cooking carrots. She works literally day and night. She had been working for a small sewing operation. She was downsized and hired back as a freelancer, which means then that she has to do all of the legwork, like going to pick up the fabric, going to get the assignments, mailing things back. So she literally works from the minute she wakes up in the morning and through the night. But I went back a few times. I met her in the pantry, and then we were cooking one day, and then another day we were sewing at night. And I think her life then becomes dimensional. And it's always my work to try to show how we're all connected, not how we're different.
And she looks tired in this photograph. She just looks a little tired. Was this the only photo of May that appeared in the exhibition?
No, there's also a short video of May. But I'll tell you about her space. She may look tired, but you would never know it to spend time with May Tate. She is on fire and friendly. And very quick to point out, I invited her to do something with me attached to the exhibit, and she was very clear to say, I am no longer going to the pantry, Joey.
Oh, is that right?
I needed it, and I'm so grateful it was there, but I'm good now, and I won't be going back until I need it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, the people I work with are proud and careful.
Yeah. What is your next project?
I have a couple of ideas. One is sort of growing out of the work I've done on this project and on the library project and then some work I've done in Latin America. It's how do we value strong motherhood? What is the actual value to society? And trying to look at it in a way that's more science-based and less sweet.
Right.
It's not just a Mother's Day thing.
Right.
And to that point, if you don't mind, being a parent myself and relating to both the men and women on the line, it's so central to a family for the parent or the whoever's in charge to be able to give a hot meal to their family, whether that is a child or an adult child who's going out to work or someone else who's unemployed in the family. The idea that you have a family too, and that that there is some caregiving going on, because the life that people in poverty face is really no fun by and large. And I think the warmth of serving a meal and coming together for a moment, I think it helps in the fight.
Yeah, and it makes a dramatic difference in people's lives. Right. Joey O'Loughlin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're going to take you up on the offer you made during the break to put up some of your photographs and a little slideshow on our website at americamagazine.org, because they're really beautiful, and I'm sure that our listeners and our readers would love to see them.
Thank you, and thank you for having me and for talking about this issue.
Of course. When we come back after the news summary, we will be talking about prayer in the Catholic tradition. You're listening to the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129.
Number 5.
Pope Francis has called for a new style of politics built on peace and nonviolence. In his annual message for the World Day of Peace on January 1st, the Pope said there needs to be a focus on disarmament, the eradication of nuclear weapons, and an end to violence against women and children. He urged political, religious, business, and media leaders to actively build peace, saying that active nonviolence is more powerful than conflict.
Number 4.
23 Catholic scholars and pastors have signed a statement in support of 4 cardinals who wrote to Pope Francis asking for clarification on his apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitia. The statement says the cardinals raise pertinent questions about whether church teaching on the sacraments and the moral law is to be upheld, particularly around the issue of communion for divorced and remarried Catholics. They say if the Pope fails to reaffirm church teaching, it may be necessary for the cardinals to collect approach him with some form of fraternal correction. The Pope has so far not answered the request, but speaking with a Belgian magazine last week, he said everything in Amoris Laetitia was agreed by a majority of the Synod Fathers and that it's a product of all churches working together.
Number 3.
Texas bishops say they're working with the state's Catholic cemeteries on efforts to provide burial for children lost to abortion. Effective December 19th, new state regulations require the interment of the remains of all children who were lost through abortion or miscarriage at a healthcare facility or abortion clinic. The conference say many Catholic cemeteries in the state have provided these burials for years, and it will work with them to further the ministry. Meanwhile, Ohio Governor John Kasich has vetoed the so-called heartbeat abortion bill that would have banned most abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. However, he did sign a 20-week abortion ban, which is similar to a restriction already in place in 15 states.
Number 2.
The Vatican has released updated guidelines and norms for priestly formation. The document from the Congregation for Clergy reaffirms Pope Benedict's instruction that homosexual men cannot enter the priesthood. It also says education on climate change is important and recommends that women be on the staff of seminaries to encourage the ability to relate to and work with women. The document includes lessons from the clerical sexual abuse scandals, stating that courses on the protection of children are necessary. Meanwhile, the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors has launched an English language version of its website, which includes its template for guidelines on preventing sexual abuse. The website, protectionofminors.va, also includes resources for a day of prayer for the victims and survivors, as well as a mailing address to contact commission members.
Number 1.
Pope Francis has urged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to do everything possible to end the war in his country. President Assad met Monday with the Papal Nuncio to Syria, Cardinal Mario Zanari. He gave Assad a letter written by the Pope in which he asked Assad to ensure that international humanitarian law is fully respected with regard to the protection of civilians and access to humanitarian aid. The Pope called for prayers for the people of Syria at his Sunday Angelus address, where he also prayed for the victims of several terrorist attacks which had taken place in the hours earlier. These included attacks in Somalia and Turkey, along with a bomb blast during Sunday morning mass at Cairo's Coptic Cathedral complex. 25 people were killed in the blast and around 50 injured. The president of the US Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, also expressed his closeness to the victims of the attacks, offering prayers for all of those facing persecution.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.